IT infrastructure, and cloud computing. Before I begin, I'm going to first say that some of the topics in this chapter are going to seem like they're a little bit dated, antiquated, maybe holdovers from BEC materials. And to that I say, you are correct. I firmly believe that ISC, while it is a new discipline section on the CPA exam, it is not going to just have completely different, brand new, never before seen material. It is incredibly difficult to maintain a large database of questions and material that can be cycled and routed to different CPA candidates so that everyone gets kind of a different exam. There's no like one exam, hey, did you get that one question on blah, 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 blah. Obviously you don't do that anyway because that's confidentiality and all that, but the AICP has to have a gigantic test bank. And in order to do that, especially with the new material and the new discipline sections, they're going to have to use holdovers from other exams like BEC, because let's just face it, there are only so many questions that they can write. And so I believe that these questions over mainframe computers or whatever are going to be in circulation for a while. Now, obviously, the AICPA is going to test on updated and more relevant topics, but I think you're going to find some oldies but goodies in here. So I'm just going to cover it all. I'm not going to get super deep into the old stuff, but I'm going to cover it all. So if you hear me talking about mainframe computers and stuff, like, just roll with it. All right. We begin with types of computers. We have supercomputers, which are among the fastest computers available and employed for specialized applications. They're very expensive. They're used for weather forecasting, scientific simulations, graphics, nuclear energy research, etc. And they use advanced scientific and engineering applications that require a high level of parallel processing. So that's a supercomputer. Then we have a mainframe computer. So we're going from the largest to smallest. So that supercomputer, then mainframe computer, very large and expensive, simultaneously support hundreds or even thousands of users. They were originally called mainframe computers because they contained the central processor unit in a large cabinet. But today, mainframe computers are used for mission-critical applications like data processing, enterprise resource planning, customer relationship management. These are used by organizations that have a large amount of data to process, like banks, insurance companies, government agencies. So that's a mainframe computer. Mini computer, these are larger and more powerful than a personal computer, but smaller and less powerful than a mainframe. So mini computers are multi-processing systems capable of supporting up to 200 users simultaneously. Then microcomputers, also known as your personal computer, you know what that is. And then smartphones, PDAs, etc. Do people still use PDAs? Isn't that the calendar app on your iPhone? All right. So that was types of computers. Then we move into hardware. Hardware refers to the physical components of a computer system, such as the processor, the CPU, memory, storage, input, and output devices. These components work together to perform the tasks that a computer is capable of, such as running software, storing and retrieving data, and connecting to the internet. So you have your input devices like your keyboard, mouse, scanner, microphone, controller. So that your input devices feed into the central processing unit, which is the control unit, memory, which has the secondary storage, hard drive, solid state drive, optical drive, USB drive, etc. Then your output devices, monitors, printers, speakers. Input devices allow a user to enter data into a computer. You know what these are: keyboards, mouse, scanner, microphone, etc. Central processing unit, or CPU, is the main processing chip in a computer that performs most of the processing. It's the brain of the computer. It carries out the instructions. It's responsible for executing the most, for executing most instructions that the computer receives. So the performance of a CPU is often measured in terms of the number of instructions it can execute per second. So CPUs with higher clock speeds are faster and more powerful. So there's primary memory. Primary memory includes RAM and ROM. So RAM is random access memory, which is a type of computer memory that stores data temporarily while the computer is running. It's used to store instructions and data that the CPU needs to access quickly while running the program. Primary memory is typically volatile, which means that it's wiped clean when the computer is turned off, and it's typically located on the motherboard and is accessed directly by the CPU. So that's RAM, random access memory. Then there's ROM, read-only memory. It's a type of memory that's permanent or semi-permanent, written with data. It cannot be easily rewritten or modified. So ROM stores instructions that start your computer. Then we have secondary storage, like hard drives, solid-state drives, USB drives. Back in the day, we had floppy disks. Then output devices, you have your monitor, printer, speaker. Then your software, like your applications. Then your system software, which is your operating system. It's the most important type of the software. It manages everything. And then utility programs, antivirus, disk defrag, backup, disk clean, etc. Application software. Application software is software that's designed to perform specific tasks like word processing, spreadsheet, photo editing, etc. And they're broken down into various classes. There's productivity software. This is Microsoft Word, word processors, spreadsheets, etc. Graphics software to create and manipulate images and graphics, like photo editing. Multimedia software, iMovie on a Mac. I don't use Windows, so whatever you Windows people use to edit stuff. Communication software, like Zoom. Then there's games and other sorts of utilities. Programming language. This is a set of instructions, rules, and conventions that's used to create and execute software programs. It's a way of communicating with the computer and giving it specific instructions to perform a task. Programs are written in source language, which includes high-level programming languages or fourth-gen programming languages, and then converted into machine language using a compiler. So the key there is that the source program then feeds into the compiler, which gives it to the computer in a way that it can understand it. So the compiler is like a translator, essentially. So machine language, also known as code or assembly language, is a set of instructions that's written in a form that can be directly executed by a computer's CPU. It's the lowest level of programming language. That's machine language. Machine language is the lowest level. Then there's a source program, which is a set of instructions that's written in a language that's intended to be compiled by the translator and interpreted by the computer. It's the code that a programmer writes and is used to create a software program. Once the program is written, it must be compiled by the compiler in order to be executed by the computer. High-level programming languages. High-level programming languages are programming languages that are designed to be more human-readable and easier to use than machine language. So it's closer to natural language. Examples would be C, C++, Java, Python, JavaScript. Then there's fourth-gen programming languages, which is a type of high-level programming language that's designed to be more user-friendly than traditional programming languages. They're often used for database management, report generations, etc. The fourth generational programming languages are characterized by their English-like statements and commands, which makes them easier to read. Examples would include structured query language or SQL, which is used for database management. And again, a compiler is the type of software that takes the source code and converts it into a language that the computer can understand. Our next topic is networks. A network allows devices to connect and communicate with each other. There are many different types of networks. There's the personal area network, a PAN, that connects devices and other personal computing devices that are close to a person, typically within a range of a few meters. So I have an iPhone, I have an iMac, and if I want to send myself a file, I can just airdrop it. That would be a personal area network. Then there's a local area network, a LAN, which connects devices within a limited geographic area, like a home or a school. So all of the computers at my home and office are connected on a LAN. Then there's the wireless LAN. You know what that is. Then there's a value-added network, which provides value-added services such as data storage and secure transmission to businesses and organizations. VANs are often used to facilitate electronic data interchange, EDI, between trading partners. Then there's a wide area network that connects devices over a large geographic area, such as a city, country, or the entire world. The internet is the largest wide area network and connects various technologies, satellites, telephones, fiber, etc. Types of network. These are based on ownership. There's private networks and public networks. Private networks are owned and operated by a single organization or entity and are typically used to connect to devices within that organization, and they share resources and exchange data. Advantages of private networks are not accessible to the general public, so they're often more secure. They're more flexible, so they can meet the specific needs of the organization and better performance. They get better performance compared to a public network because they're dedicated to a single organization and not shared with other users. Disadvantages are they're costly, limited access, and private networks are more difficult to scale. Public networks, on the other hand, are owned and operated by third parties and are leased to users on a usage basis. So the internet is a public network. Advantages are lower cost, wider availability, very scalable. Disadvantages, lower security, lower performance. I mean, if you ever been on a network when everyone's on, it's like, what? And limited control, like you have limited control over some of the options. Next, we're going to discuss some different network topologies. So this is essentially how the resources are arranged, how the computers are arranged relative to the server, etc. So first is the bus topology, where essentially all of the computers are connected to the server like through one cable. Simple to set up. The cable goes down, gets messed up. Not good. Then there's the star topology. So you can picture a hub in the middle and of the star, and then each point of the star are like computer, 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 printer, and then server. So it's easy to set up, but if the central hub fails, then all of the connected devices will fail. Then there's the ring topology. The devices are connected in a circular configuration and data is transmitted one direction around the ring. An advantage is that it's relatively efficient because the data can be transmitted directly from one device to the next without a central hub. However, if a device fails, it can disrupt the entire network. Then there's tree topology. There's a central device called the root, and it's connected to other devices which are connected to additional devices in a hierarchy. Tree topologies are often used in large networks, like in schools or businesses. So they can reach out to each other without going through the root. But if the root or one of the intermediate nodes fail, it can infect the entire network. Then there's mesh topology. Each device is connected to every other device on the network. An advantage is that it provides redundant connections, which makes the network highly resilient. If one fails, then there are alternative paths. So you'll see a mesh Wi-Fi system where the main router connects to the many mesh towers. So it's one way to like have Wi-Fi in every strong Wi-Fi in every house, in every room in your house, if you have a mesh system or on multiple floors of a house, because essentially the router connects with the first mesh tower, then that mesh tower connects to all of the others. The only problem is if the router goes down or that first mesh tower goes down, or even the one receiving the second signal from the first mesh tower, then there can be problems. Next topic is client-server architecture. In computer networking, the client-server architecture is the standard model of communication where one device, the server, is responsible for providing a specific service to the other services, which are the clients. The client sends a request to the server, which then performs a specific task and sends a response back to the client. This model is commonly used for applications such as email, file sharing, web services. The client-server architecture can be implemented on a local area network or over the internet. Our next topic is the internet. The internet is a global network of interconnected computers and servers that communicate with each other. So let's talk about some internet related terminologies. Intranet is a private network that's used by an organization to share information and resources among its employees, members, departments. It's restricted to the organization's internal network and it's not accessible from the public internet. Extranet is a private network that shares part of an organization's information or operations with suppliers, vendors, partners, customers, etc. So it's really used for supply chain management. So these are typically protected by firewalls, virtual private networks or VPNs, so that only authorized users can access the information. The World Wide Web, WWW, which might seem ridiculous that this would be explained. However, I saw a video the other day of a guy offering Harvard students $1,000 if they could answer like 5 questions. And the first question that stumped like nearly all of them was, what does WWW stand for? They're like, wrestling? World Wide Web, WWW. It's a vast network of interconnected documents and other resources linked by hyperlinks, URLs, which stands for Uniform Resource Locator, by the way. Just a bit of trivia. Then, so the HTTP, now it's usually HTTPS, which is at the front end of a URL. It stands for Hypertext Transfer Protocol. And then getting more into the weeds, there's Transmission Control Protocol and Internet Protocol. These, if you've ever had to jack around with your network settings, like you've seen TCP, IP, like what does that mean? Well, it stands for Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol, and it's the basic communication protocol of the Internet. It's a set of rules that define how the data is sent and received over the Internet. Might be a great question right there. Like, which of the following is a set of rules that define how data is sent and received over the Internet? It's TCP, IP. Then you have your Internet Service Provider, your ISP. You know what that is. And then again, Uniform Resource Locator. It's a unique set of string of characters that identifies a specific web page. And web servers, web browsers, routers. It's a connection point between a home or network office and the internet. Gateway. It's a networking device that connects two different networks together, allowing them to communicate with each other. A bridge connects two separate LANs, local area networks, together. A switch connects multiple devices together on a computer network and forwards data packets between them. They're more advanced than bridges, and they can create multiple large area networks on a single physical interface. Proxy server, a proxy, it's a server that acts between an intermediary and a client. And so if someone wants to hide what their true IP address is, then they're like using a VPN or a proxy. A killer application, also known as a killer app, is a software program that is so useful and in demand that it drives the sales of a particular hardware platform or operating system. So these days there aren't too many killer applications. It's basically an application that's so awesome that you go buy the computer just to be able to use it. So back in the day, that absolutely was the case. Like Microsoft Excel, Microsoft Word, like that's why people buy computers. It's just their kids that end up putting games on their parents' computers. But today, like if you did some really graphics intense editing or something that just was a real resource hog, like some video editing program, you might buy like a really souped up Mac specifically just to use that program. Another example would be there's different popular video games that are available just for one particular, like maybe it's on PlayStation but not on Xbox, or it's on Xbox but not on PlayStation. You might buy the PlayStation just to be able to play that game. Then there's HTML, which is hypertext markup language. That's the old school coding language. I'm sure a lot of you had to make an HTML web page at some point in high school or college. XML, extensible markup language. It's used to store and transport data. It's platform independent. And then finally, XBRL, which is extensible business reporting language. It's the standard for electronic communication of businesses and financial data. And in 2009, the SEC mandated that all public companies have to file their financial statements using XBRL. So it's the standard for filing your financial statements. Security threats on the internet. I'm talking about viruses, Trojan horse, worm, hoax virus, and phishing. A virus is a type of malware, which is malicious software that attaches itself to a legit program or file and then is designed to replicate and spread to other computers. That's why your email gets spammed for viruses. Trojan horse disguises itself as a legit program or file, but once executed, it steals information. Unlike viruses, Trojan horses do not replicate, but they can give attackers remote access. A worm is similar to a virus in that it does replicate. It can spread to other computers, but it does not need to attach itself to a legit program. A hoax virus is messaging that is circulating through email or social media warning users of a virus that does not actually exist. Phishing is a social engineering attack that tricks users into giving sensitive information. The latest one, and it's kind of died down now, but you get a phone call. Hey, you have a serious problem with your computer. You need to let us help you right now. Well, 95% of people will hang up, but the 5% or whatever it is where they make their money. And essentially, they get old people to give credit card information and or go into their computer and essentially just give them remote access into their computer. So how do we protect against all these threats? Well, we start with a firewall, which is a security system used to control incoming and outgoing network traffic by analyzing data packets and determining whether they should be allowed through or not. There are network firewalls, which is implemented at the network level, and there's application firewalls, which is implemented at the application level. An advantage of a network firewall is they're relatively easy to set up and configure, pretty inexpensive. Disadvantages, they don't provide protection against all types of attacks like phishing, and they can't stop everything. Some advantages of application firewalls is they provide a more granular control of the traffic. They can be used to protect individual programs and data. Some disadvantages of application firewalls, they're generally more expensive and more difficult to set up and configure, and they will require more maintenance. Then you have your standard antivirus software using a virtual private network, VPN, allows users to securely connect to a private network over the internet, mask your IP, etc. So those are some ways to protect against threats on the internet. Moving on to cloud computing. Cloud computing is the delivery of computing services, servers, storage, databases, networking, software over the internet or the cloud to offer faster innovation, flexible resources, and economies of scale. So if you have cloud storage on your phone for your photos, like it's instead of going and making your own cloud server, and which would be very expensive, you pay a fractional price to be able to use a cloud computing service. So there are there's types of clouds. There's private clouds, community clouds, public clouds, and hybrid clouds. A private cloud is a cloud computing environment that's dedicated to a single organization. A community cloud is a computing environment that's shared by a specific group of organizations with similar requirements and concerns. A public cloud, it's where resources such as server storage applications are made available to the general public. This would be like Amazon, AWS, Google Cloud. A lot of these have the pay-as-you-go model. Then there's the hybrid cloud that provides benefits of both public and private. And this enables organizations to take advantage of the scalability and cost effectiveness of public clouds while having a little bit more control over their security. So some cloud computing service models. There's the infrastructure as a service, a LaaS, software as a service, SaaS, and platform as a service, PaaS. So infrastructure as a service, an example would be Amazon AWS. It's a cloud hosting service. It's infrastructure as a service. You pay a subscription fee, like you're subscribing to it, and it's infrastructure as a service. Then there's software as a service. So any type of software that you pay a subscription to, like Ninja Monthly, is a SaaS, software as a service. Then there's platform as a service. So there's like Salesforce, things like that. Let's briefly talk about some of the roles and responsibilities of these cloud service providers. They have to update their infrastructure. They have to have adequate resources. They have to make sure that their service is reliable. They have to have everything up to par with security and compliance. They have to maintain their platform and software, have everything up to date, and they have to have adequate customer service and support to help you. So they take on all of those costs so that you don't have to. You don't have to have your own server team. You pay for your infrastructure as a service for that. They handle all the billing, all that. So in order to provide all of that, all the maintenance, all keeping everything up to date, then the cloud computing company has to have a sort of governance in order to achieve all of their goals. So first, their strategy and goals, their cloud computing strategy has to align with their overall business objectives. They have to take on risk management, data security, privacy, compliance. It's a pretty big deal. Policies and procedures, roles and responsibilities, compliance, legal requirements, vendor management. So maybe they outsource a bunch of stuff. Then they have to manage the vendors, performance measurement and monitoring, training, awareness, and then what if there's a data breach, incident management and response. So let's talk about the role of the COSA frameworks in cloud computing governance. So COSA is a joint initiative which is aimed at providing guidance on enterprise risk management, internal control, and fraud deterrence. COSO has developed two important frameworks for organizations to use in their government, in their governance and risk management efforts, which is the COSO Internal Control Integrated Framework and the COSO Enterprise Risk ERM Framework. So while COSO frameworks don't specifically focus on cloud computing governance, they can be applied to help organizations address risks and implement controls related to cloud computing. The COSO Internal Control Framework is built on 5 interrelated components, which are supported by 17 principles. And applying the COSO Internal Control Framework to cloud computing governance helps organizations design, implement, and evaluate effective internal controls to help manage risks and ensure compliance with relevant regulations in the context of cloud computing. Now, I could cover the COSO governance stuff, but it's a lot, and it really doesn't lend itself to an easy audio listen. I'm sure this first chapter was even tough to get through. This is IT stuff. It is what it is. But I'm not going to unnecessarily make it horribly boring. If I can avoid it, you can go to the bottom of the Ninja Book chapter on IT infrastructure and cloud computing and check out the COSO stuff. We have a table there of the COSO, you know, control environment, risk assessment, control activities, information and communication, monitoring activities, like the crime mnemonic. And we have a table there with free 2 or 3 bullet points for each of those on this if you really want to read through it. So This happens to be the last topic of the chapter. So this concludes IT infrastructure and cloud computing.